All right, good evening, everybody. Welcome to Writers in the Round. This evening, my two guests, I've been trying to get them to come into the studio together for quite some time, and their reluctance is not because they don't want to come here and do this program, at least I don't think it is.
Not at all, don't we?
No.
It's that they're both very busy people. Paul Lukat, did I pronounce it correctly this time, Paul?
Yeah, that was good.
And Mary Romero Ferguson are both writers, and for some reason, I had it in my head that you were work colleagues, but you're not, are you? You don't work at the same place.
I know, I think...
Although what you do is sort of related in a kind of...
I know, I think the last time we talked, I misunderstood you, and I was like, yeah. No, wait, no. So, no,
we were.
Yeah, we go to the same church, and I work at the church that Paul goes to. And we both work with people.
So there's like a definite crossover in that I think we're with people quite often, sort of in a one-on-one capacity. I do case management work, and so we're I think probably working with people who are often in a troubled spot when they come to see us.
That's true for both of you?
Yeah. Not quite in the same way, but similar. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We both just came from somewhere. Well,
right. That might also be.
Most of the people you work with, Paul, are homeless people. Is that true?
Yeah, mostly formerly homeless, or if it weren't usually for a particular housing subsidy that they have, they probably would be homeless. And the subsidy that they have for housing is based on their age, so it's seniors. And so, but a lot of times they have come from a homeless situation, and a lot of times they're sort of hovering on that line, very sort of in danger at times from falling back into a homeless situation. So that's where the sort of the one-on-one case management type work comes in to help them stay stable, hopefully, in their apartment. So.
There's a comment on the stories that were published as Animal Heart by you. And somebody said, I think it was a blurb writer, actually, who said the stories focus on raggedy characters in need of redemption, whether they realize it or not, which kind of leads me to jump to, so what you do professionally informs what you do when you sit down to write.
It does sort of I would say absolutely it does. I also think in sort of a roundabout or maybe an indirect way in that I think some of the people I meet perhaps in my day job don't necessarily show up directly in a piece of fiction I come up with, but this idea that sort of what happens in the daytime, and you may find this true too, where so it's almost like the way dinosaurs become gasoline. That's how it happens for me. So I'll encounter a person, a real person, or a real situation in my day job that's tragic or something. That'll sink into my brain. And a couple few months later, it might show up in a story in a totally different form. But there'll be a way that I can sort of call back and say, oh, that sounds like it's connected to the thing that happened some months ago. Or maybe not even necessarily recognizable like that. But it's like, that thing that came out on the page is very believable, at least to me, from perhaps what I might see in the daytime with some of the folks I work with.
Yeah.
So.
Or almost like the way things throughout your day show up in your dreams.
Oh, absolutely.
Just like totally.
Yeah.
Like your brain's like, I will use whatever I come across.
Yeah.
And I'll just throw that stuff at you. Like,
that's right.
Completely different,
you know.
So
like,
it finds its way back, but just in a very different, often meaning something different, symbolizing something different, you know.
Yes, very much. And it's one of those cases, I think, where you would say, okay, I have to let that lead. Mm-hmm. I can't try to control it. I can't say, okay, that's the form it's coming to me in sort of in the muse or in my brain or whatever.
Yeah.
And I have to follow that. I can't say, okay, let me orient that back to the real thing that actually happened.
Yeah.
Because the muse is trying to say, no, the story that needs to be told is actually not the sort of the factual story of what happened, but here's perhaps some sort of, I don't want to use the term deeper because it's not necessarily deeper, I suppose, but
just
it's sort
different.
Of a different form.
Yeah. So Sometimes the facts get in the way.
Oh, yes.
You know, poets find this all the time. Like, well, I mean, I remember one of my professors saying, just because it happened doesn't mean that it belongs in this poem.
That's right.
Because
that
people will say, but it really happened. You're like, well, it's not happening here.
Right. Absolutely.
This isn't happening, you know, so just you don't confuse, you know, factual
right.
reality
right.
with artistic, you know, creation, I guess.
That's right.
Well, the whole kind of alchemical process that occurs in your subconscious is interesting to me. I have a couple of friends who work in the medical field, and you know, the advice they're always given is trying to get emotionally involved with your patients, with your
right.
the people you're caring
yeah.
for you know, a variety of reasons, which is, you know, you can say that.
Sure.
You can say it all day long, but it's going to happen.
Yeah. Oh, necessarily.
The kind of work yeah. that you do must have a profound impression on you every day. And you've got to do something with that, right?
That's right. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It would result in likely some seriously bad habits. It has resulted in bad habits, but like worse habits, which would end in things like divorce and alcoholism and such like that. If there was
because you'd be looking for an escape?
Something, yeah. You have to do something with the emotional heaviness, I think, that comes with, you know, like medical field or working with, like, sort mm-hmm. of pastoring people or doing some case management type stuff. Like, you know, it comes with a lot of emotional baggage that you have to put that somewhere. And I spent a lot of time pretending I didn't have to do that, which resulted in me staring at the wall when I would get home from work and my wife kind of being like, hey, and taking a second to kind of zone back in, I guess. So, I hesitate to use writing as like therapy, but it's helpful to have that outlet. I think.
I would think.
Yeah.
What is it that drives you to write?
I don't remember anymore. I wrote my first poem because a girl broke up with me in high school.
Oh. And this isn't good.
Yeah, but which is like
is
so
a good origin story.
Which is like so I don't know, so base. And we remain friends now, but that was sort of the beginning, and because I didn't know what to do with those sort of feelings of hurt, so I wrote this little poem. And but I do it now just because I think I love to do it, and I feel like I have to do it. Sort of compelled in a good way.
Yeah.
To do what? What is it that you're trying to communicate to the rest of us?
Well,
especially in flash fiction, where I get the feeling that with flash fiction, they're almost asking you to free write.
It starts there a lot of times for me, and that's where it gets kind of pseudo-Freudian, where you just get out of the way of your consciousness as much as you can. And then, like, I recently wrote a story over this past weekend I wrote the story and I realized that I was actually telling myself the story. And I was like, oh, shoot. And it wasn't until, like, maybe Wednesday of this week where I was like, that wasn't for... I'm going to share it with people, hopefully, but that was me trying to tell myself something that was maybe a little too painful for me to consciously sort of realize. So I had to do it. So it was like this battle of getting out of the sort of self-editing, you know.
Yeah.
I think with flash fiction, and I wonder what your thoughts would be on poetry, because sometimes it gets close, the two. But there's this idea that the story is like a hit. And then the resonance is what happens, is where the impact is. So if you go and you read like a piece like Steinbeck, and it's 300, 400, 500 pages, the impact is while you're reading it. And of course, you can think about it afterwards and mull it over. But with a piece of flash fiction, it takes about 20 seconds to read. And then, but it should be, I compare it to, you know, maybe a taste of a good whiskey. Like, there should be a long after glow, aftertaste, I think.
Do you find the stuff that you write as flash fiction is a seed for something you later write that's longer and goes into more detail?
I haven't yet. So they're typically standalone. And that's another thing, when the muse, for lack of a better term, visits, she often will inform me ahead of time as I sit down to write, this is only going to be about a page and a half. Or she'll say, you know, buckle up, because this will be quite a bit longer. And I'm working through a novel right now, and she's like, just hold still.
this might take a while.
which is hard to do for me. So
yeah.
Share something with us, would you?
Sure. I recently visited New Orleans for the first time in my life. Mm. And so as a writer or as like an artist, I can't imagine having, and I was just there for a week, and I can't imagine having any experience with the city of New Orleans that you don't have something to say about it, whether you've lived there your whole life or you've just been there like me just for a week. So while I was there, I was furiously scribbling in my notebook because it is so, it's impossible to describe sort of these words. So I was like, I'm going to.
Creatively dense.
extremely. Yeah. And there's so much richness and culture, and there are some high highs in the city and there are some low lows in the city. It's like 2 o'clock in the morning and we're as far away from Mardi Gras on the calendar as we can possibly be, yet there's still a band going down the street. And like, you don't want to miss stuff. So you're like, it's 2 a.m. I'll go out there.
I think, you know, every city has a personality.
Oh, yes.
And New Orleans has, Mary is suggesting, this incredibly powerful personality.
Yes. Yeah. Very.
Quite hedonistic.
Yes.
Well, that's true, too.
It's not just
the hedonism, you know, although that's certainly, especially in the French Quarter and that part of the city, you get the sense that this is the place, as they say, that care forgot, in every sense, that care forgot. Yeah. You know, nobody cares, you know, is one way to read that. Yeah. You can do whatever you like here, which is an appalling thing to do to a city.
Well, it was very, I think that's a good way to put it, because the hotel that we stayed in was in the French Quarter.
Yeah.
And so it was Bourbon Street in Canal Street. So it was like, well, let me just get my little cigar and take a stroll just as slow as I can down Bourbon Street to as far as I can go until the lights are out, and then I'll turn back around and go the other way and just see what happens. And it was like, to my artistic sensibilities, like overwhelming.
Yeah.
It was like, there is so much. There is abject poverty. There is desperation. There are these sort of like straight-laced business dudes who are coming out of these like strip clubs just rocked, and you're like, you would not do this, but since you're in this little weird place in the world where nobody cares, like very quickly you became somebody that you were not your entire life. And so it's just like it's fascinating. Yeah. Just like a fascinating study in I don't know, like human culture, behavior, and people watching is like on a grand scale.
On a grand scale.
in some ways, maybe it's, you know, that there's that notion that all of us can only handle so much control, and that you need a safety valve.
Yes.
And New Orleans is a safety valve for the whole country. That you can go down there, you know, and for a while, as you were saying, be like this guy who goes to church on Sunday and tends his garden and all the rest of it, and then goes down there and becomes this bacchanalian hooligan for a few days. You know?
and ostensibly, I mean, I'm presuming, but you know, people are down there, and they're, I would guess, you know, 99% of the people are not from New Orleans, except for the people who are sort of know how to work those people, and so. And they're ostensibly there for like business trips and stuff. Like you're using your per diem on your your 8th alcoholic slushy. Anyway,
so confessional.
Yeah. So this is a story from there, and I worked up a chat book of flash fiction from my New Orleans, but this is a story from that chat book. So it's called Confessional. One night, gone on Sazerac and roll 'em up cigarettes, I found myself at a fortune teller's table in the night shadow of San Luis Cathedral. San Luis. The fortune teller took my hand in both of her hands, smooth and pale with long fingers, and tilted it back and forth, this way and that, in the pale streetlight. You've got a lot going on here, she said. Oh yeah? I said, bad or good? Just a lot. Like what? I started, but she shushed me. She looked up when I chuckled. I'm sorry. I don't want to spook the mojo. I'll shut up. You can't spook the mojo, she said. I bet I could. That's not how it works anyway. Do tell, how does it all work? Well, and she curled my fingers up into a loose fist and held it in her hands for a long time. Then she said, sometimes the spirits don't have much to say. I snorted. They don't know me on the other side or what? I think they know you. What then? They just don't want to talk? I'm sorry. She let go of my hand. So what about them? Think they can tell me anything in there? I gestured to the enormous church. The fortune teller turned and gazed at the church for a long time. When she turned back, she said, the last time I was in a church, not that one, I told the priest I gave myself an abortion in high school. I used my mother's knitting needle. That's a hell of a confession. What else could I say? And then, but my God, are you okay? Tell me that now. Please say you're okay. Little tears fogged my eyes. I was as drunk as I've ever been. I don't hold on to grudges, baby, she said. That was a long time ago. So that's confessional. Mm. I was amazed because the San Luis Cathedral Basilica was there when that was part of Spain. And so it was this beautiful Catholic church, and all around at all hours of the night are just fortune teller booths all around the church. Mm. And so there's this amazing sense of, I'm not even sure how to describe it. And then there was one fortune teller booth where it was a dude with a puppet, and the puppet was the fortune teller. And so there was like this broken veneer of like, this stuff is real. Like it's not real. So much so that I'm using a puppet to tell you your fortune.
Or conversely, you know, as has often been said, the puppet tells things that.
That's right. That's right.
That we wouldn't say or couldn't say.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
Yeah, it was completely. I loved it. I was like, look at all these people, and they're lining up to get their fortunes told, and then like right behind them, they could go and they could go to confession, and so it's like all here, like all any spiritual anything you could want, including like anti like just on the other side of. This big giant church is Bourbon Street, so you don't need. You can do it all here, and then go over here and deal with your guilt, and then go on back.
It's like, man, it's kind of interesting that they should be, you know, in such close proximity to the church. It maybe speaks to the relationship that they have.
There's some relationship there, and I
you know that Haitian voodoo that was brought over here by the slaves into Mississippi and Louisiana. Is a belief system in its way as valid and potent as the Catholic Church and has kind of a uneasy commonality with it.
Mm, it's interesting because when I was walking up and down Bourbon Street and my buddy and I, we sat down on some steps to take a rest and we're like, oh, this is Madame Laveau's house. This is weird. This is a weird place to rest. She welcomed us on her front step at least.
This is Writers in the Round. If you're just joining us, my guest Paul Lukas and Mary, who hasn't had the opportunity to say very much, but certainly will, Mary Romero Ferguson. Mary is a pastor at Mission Chattanooga, as is your husband, I think.
Yeah.
Ben.
Yeah.
Mary is also, and I've never heard this word before, a precentor.
Okay, so you found an old description of my
job. Okay,
so there was this period of time at the mission, which is hilarious. This is hilarious. We
was
still precentor. It sounds like I'm half horse.
You're like centaur, right?
No,
yeah, I didn't think about it like that.
Oh,
but I see
gosh.
Your point.
No, there was this period at the mission when we thought it would be really fun to come up with like really old school liturgical names for all of our jobs. That passed, but I think for some reason mine stuck around longer than anyone else's.
It's really cool.
I know.
It is cool.
Yeah, I was like the liturgist. I would take care of different. You know, elements of the liturgy or write different elements of the liturgy. And so somehow they pulled that old term out and that's what they called me. for a long time.
Yeah, they described you as the Minister of Arts, Writing, and Liturgies, which sounds great. I mean, it sounds like something out of New Orleans, actually, doesn't it?
Right, yeah.
It's fantastic. Yeah, no, I love it. I love it. I know, I got that job, and then about a year later, I had a baby. And so a lot of those elements of my job sort of went away. But now they're all coming back, which is fantastic. In fact, Paul was at my house. We did a, this is the second time we've done it. We did a 48-hour artist retreat where we kind of had a theme this time it was dirt. It was just dirt. So we sort of looked at it in Genesis, looked at, you know, the occasions of that image. And then everybody just went off and they had to write something and finish it within 48 hours. We had some sculptors too, which were, they loved the theme. They're like, we can do whatever we want. We literally are using dirt. So that was super fun. Paul wrote a great story. And anyway, so.
So is this anything like the flash fiction kind of stuff that Paul is doing? Didn't necessarily want people to write.
Well, I mean,
in a fever dream is how it feels like with the Paul stuff.
You know? Yeah, it's sort of what you could do within 48 hours. So some people did some sort of creative nonfiction essays. A couple of people wrote short stories. We had painting. We had some sculptures. It was super cool.
And it was all inspired by parts of Genesis?
Yeah, I mean, when we do it, we try to basically say, okay, we try to pick something that's really tactile. And then we maybe do a little bit of teaching, kind of like look at the resonances of it in the scripture. But then we sort of say, okay, go. You're free to, it can be super loose. It doesn't have to, because I mean, inspiration needs a little bit, sometimes needs a little bit, but if you tie it down too loosely, it's pretty tough. So it was definitely, here's a little bit of fodder and then feel a lot of freedom.
Absolutely.
Within the 48-hour constraint.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
So it was, yeah, that's been fun. It's been fun to do things like that.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Super awesome.
Yeah.
So it strikes me that among the things that you have in common is that you both sort of have these very powerful dual streams in your life. The work you do is my assumption would be that it's relatively demanding in its way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You're married to Ben.
Yes.
You have two daughters.
Yes, two lovely daughters.
And you have a master's degree.
I do.
You work as a pastor mm-hmm. alongside your husband. Is that true?
I do. Yeah.
So what is your role as you work at Mission Chattanooga?
I do. I work at Mission Chattanooga.
Which is in Highland Park.
So not anymore.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's recent. So my husband and I planted the Highland Chapel, which was in Highland Park. And then recently, just a few months ago, we've merged the city center location, which meets at the camp house, with the Highland Chapel congregation. So we've all merged together.
So you're part of camp house.
So yeah, I'm
gotcha.
Part of, yeah. And then the reason we merged is because we're all moving into a new building together in March.
And my understanding of the camp house was that's an Anglican
yes.
belief?
Yes. Yeah. So I'm an Anglican deacon. My husband's an Anglican priest. And
yeah. You know, people say Anglicans are Catholics post Henry VIII.
Yeah. Yeah. I grew up Catholic, so, you know, it was like, actually both my husband and I grew up Catholic. And then we both kind of came to an adult faith outside of the Catholic Church, and then we sort of made our way halfway back. So that's how we're Anglican. I know it's called the Via Media, the Middle Way. So, you know, it is kind of midway between, it's has the liturgy of, you know, that, you know, and the Eucharist that you would find familiar, but also more emphasis on the word, on teaching, on other aspects that you would find more in a Protestant church. It's a little bit of both. Some people call it Catholic light.
What do you mean more of an emphasis on the liturgy? How does that manifest?
Well, I mean, more emphasis on the liturgy in comparison to, you know, in a Catholic mass, which I love, but you'll get a very short teaching, whereas in most Protestant churches, they're, you know, it's sort of it. You know, some of them you won't even you'll never get the Eucharist. You go there and you listen to like a hour-long sermon. We don't do that. But, you know, we have more like a 25-minute teaching. So Anglicanism places an equal emphasis on, they would say, word and sacrament. So it's, you know, whereas, like, there's sort of a split where over here, you know, it seems more sacrament. Over here, it seems more word. Another reason why it's called the middle way, it's sort of holding those two things together.
That makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah.
Well, the way you're describing it, it makes it sound as if it's less formalized.
Yeah. I mean,
because I grew up Catholic too.
Yeah.
And went to Catholic school.
Yeah.
And
bless you.
Because you get the sense that you're being what is being inculcated in you is this ancient belief system that nobody questions anymore. Everybody just says, this is the way it is.
Yeah.
Well, why is that? Oh, that's just the way it is. And to tell a 14-year-old that's just the way it is, it's a complete waste of time, because we're just going to, especially in the 1960s.
It's not going to fly. It's not going to fly. Yeah.
Catholicism met its match in the 1960s.
No, for sure. Yeah. Yeah. Anglicanism is interesting because it's actually the third largest denomination in the world. And it's held together by a book of common worship, not by like a common dogma as much. And so when it moves into different countries, it morphs as it kind of should. You know, so it's interesting because you can worship with Anglicans all over the world and it looks and feels and sounds different. And yet there's a little stream of commonality, which I like knowing that I'm sort of friends with people. You know, there's something cool about, you know, being in communion with, you know, our African brothers and our South American brothers and our Chinese brothers. So anyway, it's a neat thing.
Given that philosophy, do you ever find that your two lives sort of blur a little bit?
Oh,
your life as a writer and your life as a pastor?
Yeah. I mean, I do. They do cross over at times. But I don't know. Sometimes I think I should let them cross over more, but I tend to hold them a little bit. Oh. I don't know, a little bit apart. It just seems easier to like put on a hat over here and put on, not that they're not both integral. That sounds like I'm faking it or something, but you know what I mean? There's
not necessarily, but I would think it's a bit of a challenge to do that.
Yeah, no. Yeah. I think it can be, because there is something about, I mean, like, to be a pastor basically means to be a shepherd. There is something that's like you're trying to hold together, you know, your own faith, the faith of other, you know, there's a guardedness, a protectedness. And not only that, but, you know, that's an aspect of it. Whereas I think you sort of have to let all the guards down when you write in order to write truthfully, to write well. You can always edit back, but if you start from a guarded place, like, you'll never get to the kernel of truth, you know.
That's what Paul was talking about with his flash fiction, right?
Letting down. You're extremely good at that. This, like...
it takes a lot. It takes, you know this too, I mean, it takes a lot of practice in a very sort of... In the same way that an athlete who wants to be good at their thing, they just have to practice by repetition. And I think with sort of getting the conscious stuff out of the way is a practice. Some people are better at it at the start. Some people aren't. Like, I wasn't very good at it at first. But the more that you just kind of, it's almost like a muscle memory, except it's sort of like a brain, a creative spirit.
Well, I guess, it's probably been way overused, you know, Gladwell's notion that you do something for 10,000 hours and you master it, you know?
Yeah.
I often wonder about that. I'm like, how long have I been running?
I know. I'm like, I wish I'd been clocking all these hours.
Yeah, like, I wish
how
I had like,
far
a,
along
like
am
my
I?
step thing, but for like words, like, for hours.
Yeah.
I think when you quantify something like that, first of all, it's probably not true anyway, because it's going to be different for each person.
Absolutely.
But there comes a point, as Paul was just saying, muscle memory, where you have mastered the craft, and so you can let go.
Yeah.
You don't have to worry about the rules anymore. You know what the rules are.
Yeah.
You can express yourself.
They're part of you. Seamus Heaney has a beautiful metaphor for it. He talks about the beginner poet or writer, what they're doing, he's they're at a well and they're lowering a bucket into the well. And the bucket only goes down like halfway. And so every time you lower that bucket down and then back up again, it's just this frustrating thing because you're coming up with nothing. You know, yeah. A lot of the early, yeah, all of the early writing stage, you're just coming up with nothing. He's like, but then you learn that motion so well. And one day it's just, you know, this incredibly clear, gorgeous water comes up, you know, and you have something, you know, and you know how to do that again and again and again. So you know how to lower the bucket. You know how to keep lifting it up. Those muscles are there, which I love. And, you know, sometimes you do. It's just, you keep lowering that bucket.
I love that. I love that description.
And then sometimes the well is dry, and that's it.
which is an expression a lot of writers use, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I it's funny. A few weeks ago, I finished in a mad dash. I finished this manuscript that I've been working on for about a year and a half, and it's all written in another voice, and it was just exhilarating. You know, sort of this mad dash at the finish. I was writing sort of this furious fever, and you know, getting people to read and getting comments and editing, and you know, and then after it was over, the next Monday, I was like, well, it's my writing day. I have to sit down to write, and I just. The well was dry. I was like, there is nothing there. I kept on doing it for about 3 weeks. I kept on sitting down. And then finally I said, I think I'm postpartum. I think I just had a baby. I think I need to take a break.
Yeah, yeah.
I hadn't thought about that. I was like, maybe just a couple weeks of like filling, you know, fill the well back up. Like let it rain a little bit, for goodness sake.
I mean, finishing a manuscript is a humongous deal. Like,
humongous deal of
time and emotional energy.
Yeah, so it was, yeah. And that is probably the most kind of bereft I've felt, too, after, you know, we talk about the muse and it's sort of, I don't know, writers have this, you know, how much is inspiration, how much is perspiration, which, of course, it's both. You have to work really, really hard. But then there's these moments, with this manuscript, it was like this voice descended and then stayed with me for like over a year, and now she's gone.
I
miss her. Like, it's very strange. It's like I felt her leave. You know?
Oh, man.
Which is, I've heard writers talk about this. I've never experienced myself. I always kind of thought it was maybe like a little bit too like voodoo witchcraft for me. But I'm like, no, it's real. She's gone.
Bring her back.
Bring her back.
Oh. And when she was gone, was the story finished? Did you feel as if the story was finished?
No, it was complete. It was, you know, it landed. It was done. So, you know, I handed it off to friends. They were like, this is whole. This is it. This is,
well, you know, there are a lot of songwriters who talk about Willie Nelson, for one, said every guitar has a song in it.
Oh, yeah. You know? I love that.
And there are people who say, I didn't really write that song. It came through me.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, it's weird because I think a lot of writers, songwriters, you know, creators feel that way. Not all the time. Like there is like the 80% of the time where you're just working hard to write something and you create something and it's good. And then it's strange how often it's probably the most memorable thing that you've ever done is the thing that comes to you almost whole, and you feel... It's almost humbling because as you offer it out to the world, you kind of feel this sense of like, it doesn't entirely belong to
me. Yeah,
you know,
I think that's
like
true.
I got to be, you know, you feel like a partnership. Like I got to partner with this beautiful idea, you know, or this beautiful thing. I mean, I was listening to someone was reading Robert Frost, Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening, which he wrote. That was the experience he had with that poem. He sat down one evening. He wrote it, it came out whole, you know, and the moment after he wrote it, he wrote a letter to a friend and he said, I think I've just written my bid for remembrance. Like, this is it. This is the poem that I will be remembered by, and this is the poem that people will remember, and it just came, you know, which is...
And he was kind of right, like that.
Yeah, and he was right, like, he knew it, he called it, he felt, you know, he felt whatever it was that came in and out through him, Yeah, it sounds so mystical and strange, but I believe in it now.
Well, it seems to me that maybe there's a commonality with making a garden.
Yeah.
We see these beautiful gardens. And, wow, look how pretty that is. Somebody has done an enormous amount of work to create this thing that is not really theirs.
Yeah.
You know, they put all the seeds, they did all the cultivation and all the rest of it, but in the end, you just let it go, and that's what happens.
And it's incredible.
Seems like the process for you and for Paul is similar, that you use, the whole notion of going down to the well and you don't go deep enough, you can't get what it is you want to bring up.
Yeah.
At some point, all of that tilling that you've done bears fruit.
Yeah. I think that's definitely the hope, at least. And it's nice to sort of reprove it to yourself every time you write something that's halfway decent.
Yeah.
Because there's always that fear of like, well, maybe that was the last one. Maybe that was the last gold nugget in the soil that I've been given. And it's nice to find out that you're, there's at least one more.
Yeah. Yeah.
Would you care to share some of your manuscript, Mary?
Sure, yeah.
And it still is in manuscript form, huh?
Yes. Yeah, I've sent it out to quite a few competitions, but it'll be months before I hear anything back, so we'll find out. I knew that Paul and I were going to be doing this, so I thought I'd read something that's short and kind of a tiny bit creepy. So it just felt in keeping with being here with Paul. So,
creepy. So, right.
I mean, it's just short. So in this manuscript, it's all written in the voice of Penelope, who is the wife of Odysseus, and she's famous for her faithfulness, because she waits for Odysseus for 20 years. And I really wanted to just play with this idea of, I still wanted her to be faithful, but so I have her fall in love with someone else, of course, while he's away. I mean, 20 years.
Come on.
Right? So I'm playing with all these different, I wanted to play with faithfulness as something that's a little bit more dynamic, that's not just the static, Penelope's always shown in, as like sitting,
And there's dudes all around her.
But actually, I mean, in the Odyssey, she's crazy smart, super witty, Anyway, she's really interesting. So these are really short. Do you mind if I read a couple in a row? Okay. So this is called Hunger. My mind, without the food of you, gnaws on itself, I fear, like the mottled swallowtail caterpillars I fought to feed during the drought. With nothing left but thin stalks of parched parsley and dill to satisfy their hunger, they began to eat each other. This is desire. That insidious snake slipping in and out of every improbable crack in one's house. It will come and go when and where it wants, and it always wants for you to chase it. Is fidelity merely an absence of lust? Is it lust to hunger for another's mind? I keep watching the slippery thing with fascination and fear as it begins to slide under the door. So that's just the beginning of her realizing that she's kind of falling in love with someone else and freaking out, So she does remain faithful. Gosh, I'm giving spoiler. she does remain faithful, but it is a struggle. And then it's, it was fun to play like, at the end of the Odyssey, Odysseus comes home and there they are, happily married again, so it was kind of fun to play with the ending of what is it really like to then be married again to someone who's been gone for...
Who's essentially a stranger.
Yeah, who is essentially a stranger and, who's probably got like PTSD like crazy.
That's right. I gotta tell you about some stuff that happened. Some stuff happened.
Yeah, seriously. So anyway, it's been fun. So when he returns, this one's called What's Left Out. So it's sort of after Odysseus has come home. And she says, details I omitted. The monthly cleaning of sandal straps, kneading arches of worn feet each night. How long it takes to dye and spin anything resembling thread. Every new phrase and face our son would mimic. All the times the gods didn't speak. The slaughter of the wolf pack of the suitors on Apollo's feast day. The strung bow's thwack after each arrow's release. My relief at one man's absence, having sent him away weeks before. The freedom a frail fidelity lavished on him. The feeling of a knife-twisted gut at the smell of the hall sticky with entrails and incense, the blood spreading like poppies in the wind, the violence of return, even apart from the violence, how I feared you, how I wanted you, eventually, how you would tell me anything I asked, how I would tell you everything. So... a little bit of complicated.
Yeah, that's awesome.
I keep thinking if whether they meant that literally 20 years, because if you think in terms of the lifespan of people in that point in time in
history.
I know,
right?
that's a big chunk of a life, isn't it?
It is. I mean, yeah, because it would have been 10 years at the Trojan War, and then 10 years of his journey home is, you know, what the story tells us, but it is hard to imagine, and it is hard to imagine someone being faithful for 20 years. But it was,
well, you know, obviously she didn't just sit there pining away for 20 years, right?
Yeah, no, not at all.
She was living a life, and that's where you took off from.
Yeah,
and that's rich stuff.
Yeah, it's fun. It was
because
fun.
Nobody's told that story, right? Nobody's ever thought to ask, well, wait a minute, you know, okay, Odysseus is out there, you know, slaying beasts and all the other things that he's doing.
Yeah, it's more. I kind of approached it as this is her odyssey. But it's more of an internal and grounded one, you know. Whereas his is off in the ocean. The little poem at the beginning, you know, is called Odyssey, and she basically says, you know, that the greatest distance is between the mind and the heart, you know, and that's what she's traveled. Is that vast distance between the mind and the heart. So that's kind of, this is the odyssey that she takes. As a woman in that time who couldn't have really taken any other odyssey, you know, any other journey. I did sneak a poem in here that I actually wrote for my husband. And then after, which I actually wrote before I wrote the manuscript, and now it's the second to last poem in the collection, because I found it and I said, oh my gosh, it's perfect. The imagery in it. I was like, this is Penelope before I knew her. but can I read it?
Please do. Yeah,
I know.
Absolutely.
Poor Ben. He never gets a bone.
Oh, no, this is great.
I'll just throw him one. So this is called Island Sea to Ben through Odysseus. This island is so saturated with green, it's almost black in the dense morning. The coming light will set us straight. Birds rustle up as I pass a low ruin. Stones a gruff old man removes to build a stairway to the sea. Now they're useful and beautiful to descend to the million grains of sand and water too endless to excavate. I am alone in all the world until a whale, elusive creature, breaks the surface, clearly lit for a breathless instant. I think of you. There's so much unexplained, such surprises still emerging from your sea. After these many years, I've learned to let the waters be. Vast as you are, you will not fill my valleys, our loves forever incomplete. I can at last let you, husband, be mystery, ourselves autonomous and joined as island, sea.
Mm. Has he heard that?
He has.
Okay.
He has.
That's going to win one of those contests. That's going to win a contest. I'm not kidding. That's going to win a contest. One
hope
of those contests.
So. I hope so. I can say that now because it feels other than me.
Yeah.
You know, it's weird.
I was
weird.
Wondering about
it's,
that, yeah.
It's like a strange, I remember Christian Wyman, who I love, he's a poet that I love, talking about this. He said, you know, the funny thing, like when you're writing, it almost has nothing to do with you. You get so caught up in the work. That there's no ego in it. It's just about the work. And he's like, and the part that sucks is afterwards when you feel like you have to sell yourself, yeah. you know, in order to like to get the work into the world. But I mean, the way that I keep thinking about it is like, if you serve the work by writing it, you then have to serve the work by sending it out. Mm-hmm. You know, it's still, you know, it doesn't have to be self-serving. It's like a way of serving the created thing.
Yeah, that's a helpful way to think about it.
Yeah, otherwise I get too, my ego gets too in it, and, oh, yeah. and it's too either inflated or fragile. Yeah. Oh, yeah. you know? Oh, yes. Or both at the same time, which yeah. we've talked about.
Yeah, it's
I'm the best, I'm the worst.
Terrible. terrible.
All the things, yeah.
Well, it takes a huge amount of energy to produce something.
Yeah.
And I think the only way that you can retain your sanity in that kind of situation is to give yourself over to the work mm-hmm. and then let it go. It's not yeah. yours anymore.
Yeah, it has to.
Your part is done.
Yeah.
And now it's up to those
like
receiving it to.
Yeah. I know. I mean, I take heart. Some of my favorite poets ever. I mean, didn't get read while they were alive. So I hope that's not the case, you know, for myself.
Yeah.
But I have to still say, you know, there's moments when you go, you know, you just don't know. You do the work, you're faithful to it, and then yeah, and then you let it go and it'll find its the way that it needs to find. Mm. You know, you hope. But I don't know. I've been reading have you read Big Magic? By
no.
Elizabeth Gilbert.
I have not yet.
Oh, it's it's a book length pep talk.
I'll take it. That's great.
For creatives. It's good. It's a good like pump you up. But she says it's just like creators have to hold this paradox in tension. One is that this is what you're doing is the thing that matters most in the whole world, which you have to believe for the sake of your creative endeavor. The second is that it really doesn't matter at all.
Yeah.
That you have to believe for your sanity.
Yeah.
And she's like, you have to sort of believe the two things at the same time.
I've got to check that out. That sounds very healthy.
It's helpful. Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
Well, the hardest part is it's as you were saying before about that relationship that you had with Penelope.
Yeah.
At some point it's going to go away.
I know.
And
she's
you're just going to, that's the hard part. That's that postpartum feeling.
I know it's well. It is. It does. I know. And now that I, you know, have, you know, now two human children and one fully creative child. You know, I'm like, well, they're just now they're gonna go do their own thing. They gotta walk in the world. They gotta find their own way.
I can't hold their hands.
I can't step along beside them and explain to everyone. I know that she said that, but this is what she actually means.
Yeah.
I can't do that. You know, you have to sort of trust and let it go and.
Yes.
I don't know.
Very hard.
It's a little bit like parenting.
Well, I'm curious is if there's any commonality there with what you do in the church.
Oh.
And the kind of work you do.
I mean, now that you say that, I think I need to get better at that. I mean, in the sense of you walk into people's lives and you just walk through things with them. And then at some point, you do have to let go. I mean, and anyone who's in a helping profession, I think, experiences that sense of, you know, oh, gosh, now I just have to, you know, the hardest work is to trust. I mean, it's like people that I dearly love, you know, like a really, really good friend. I mean, when she got divorced, and I was just, oh, awful. It was almost, I shouldn't say this. There were things that there were aspects of it that were easier for her to let go of than it was for me because I wanted so badly to help, you know, and then learning like I can't, I have to trust, like I have to let go, you know, I have to let go of my anger or whatever, you know, you have to let go of those things. I don't know. Sometimes you can hold other people's wounds almost closer than your own because like you actually have to heal in order to be alive. Whereas other, you know, you don't know what's happening inside another person. So I don't know.
Absolutely.
At least I've experienced that. So I'm learning.
Well, I think it's interesting, you know, to go back to that again. The work you do and the work you do as writers.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if one feeds the other.
Yeah.
If the insights that you gain from the work you do help your writing and conversely, the insights that maybe you gain from writing help you with the work you do on a daily basis?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think, I mean, I never really put these two things together, but thinking about this whole manuscript being about faithfulness and quite a difficult marriage, it was kind of after a season where I walked through a lot of, you know, I walked with a lot of people through really difficult marriages, so much lasted and so much didn't. So I'm sure that that was marinating, you know, in the background. And, you know, this is no, you know, no character in this manuscript is related to any particular person in reality. But.
Well, you said that you don't use writing as therapy and that you, but.
Writing could be a pause for therapy.
Yeah, what you have written allows people to go to places vicariously that they may not be at all comfortable going personally, but they can go there in through somebody else's eyes, much like Mary looking at Penelope and Penelope's life. It's a way for us to go inside other people's heads and yet at the end realize, no, it isn't anybody else's, it's yours.
That's right. Well, I think there's something to that. In those darkest moments, whether it's, whether in a piece of fiction, if there's a very dark moment or the whole thing is dark, it does offer the opportunity for the author to also explore what could be the antidote to that darkness.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that looks like different things in my stories. Sometimes I try to offer that and sometimes I don't. And if that opportunity for the antidote is perhaps past, maybe I'll offer it to a character, but they decide to pass on it. What are the consequences of that? Maybe they've grasped at it and missed. And what are the consequences of that? Where you're just sort of unlucky and also in trouble. Or what happens if you grab it? So there's a way that the darkness provides an opportunity for sort of a feeling of perhaps rescue. If I can't think of a better term than that. And maybe that's why a reader would go to a dark story, because it's like, okay, but what can this teach me about the opportunities in my own life where something can be of a sort of a rescue for me, whatever that looks like.
Yeah, like as a writer or a reader, sometimes it's an opportunity to take a different road without having to take it.
That's right.
You know what I mean?
That's
like you get to experientially go down that road and then go, whoa.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
Then pull yourself back like, that is not, okay, that's not the road I want to take.
Yeah,
you know, and then
sure.
I think there's something deeply human and necessary about our imaginations needing that.
Yeah. They need to be fired by that challenge from time to time, I think.
Yeah,
the imagination and the spirit needs to be sort of woken up.
Well said. Well said.
Yeah.
So where can people go if they want to read your work, Mary? Other than what you have been reading, which is yet to be published.
Well, one on my list of things to do this year was make a website.
Oh, yeah.
Which is an excellent idea.
Yes.
Maybe by December 31st, I will have a website because it's. You know, the year is quickly going away. And it's on my list. And I've done all the other things I had on my list of things
Nicely
to do this
done.
Year.
Well done.
So I felt
well
really
done.
Good about this year. So, hopefully I'll have a website. I used to have like a WordPress, but.
Have you ever considered reading your work and putting it on the web?
Like reading it aloud? Mm-hmm. I think it would be fun. I'd love to do that. I love to read things out loud. Anything. You can just hand me anything. I read to my kids all day long, and they're like, "Nah, that's enough. Mommy, no more. more books."
Give me a call if you want to do that.
That would be fun. I'd love to do that. Yeah.
That's how I practice reading, is reading to my kids. So I'll do, so like if I have any success at a reading of my own stuff, it's because I've read. I'm very familiar with the rhythms of Dr. Seuss and these things like that. And
The invitation's open to you too, Paul.
Oh, I'd love
if you'd
to.
Like
that
to.
Would be fantastic. I would love to.
That'd be super fun.
I would.
Do you have a website?
No, I don't. That takes some creative energy, and then it's always like, but I should be putting that creative energy into my work, and so I end up going that way. So I have these quarterly done, half done websites. That are not published.
I know.
That are really janky. And
maybe you should just get somebody else to do it for you.
Well, I have to pay them. You have to give them money.
I know. We have some mutual friends that have told me that they would help me set up a website. Okay. So maybe we could just do a little website tutorial.
That would be all together. Okay. I'm definitely in for that because evidently. Because
I don't know. That's why I don't. I'd had a WordPress for a little while, and then I'm so technologically a poet who's not good at technology.
Absolutely.
Breaking news. Yeah.
Well, I feel like it used to be back in the late 90s, the dumbest websites were people who were like, read my poetry. And now it's like, we have to have those websites that say, read my poetry or read my fiction or whatever.
Well, it's just the only way that people can
find you now.
So it is. It's a very strange
You can go one of two ways. Like you can go like, you know, there's all this advice and we're not there yet. We will be at some point where we can be like legit recluses and not have to like a J.D. Salinger or something.
Yes.
We're not there yet, but at a certain
come
point.
Come, Lord, come.
Yeah, it's going to happen where it's like, I don't have to maintain a website. My mystique is all that is like, this dude wrote Holden Caulfield, like, and somehow everybody's like, this is just this giant, and what's he doing at his house?
Or someone else will start putting your stuff up on the web because they like it enough. That would be nice.
That would be nice. Super nice.
Yeah.
I think J.D. Salinger spent most of his life trying to get away from J.D. Salinger.
I think he really did. You heard Urban Myth that people would go to try to find his little house in this town, and the town was all in on it, so they'd misdirect these sort of tourists, and they'd say, oh, yeah, it's at this address, and you'd go there, and it would just be like a broke-down farmhouse or something. And then everybody was like, oh, I get it.
He does not want to be found.
He doesn't want to be found.
Didn't Oscar Wilde say, learning to love oneself is the beginning of a lifelong relationship?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
JD needed a little bit of that.
So your short story collections are available through the usual suspects?
Yeah, I mean...
Amazon, I think?
Yeah, so Animal Heart you can still find on Amazon. The other, I have a flash fiction collection called Brief Instructions that's available. So that press is called Ghostbird Press. ghostbirdpress.com, and it can be found there. And that's for that collection, that's the only place it can be found. Or the several copies at my parents' house.
Should we close with another of your flash fiction pieces?
Sure. I'll share a piece from this collection called Suicide Notes. Maybe I'll come up with a better title than that. But I'm a big fan of the writer Hunter S. Thompson, and he committed suicide. And he died in 2005, so in the somewhat recent era. And so when his it was tragic, his family was in the other room, and he shot himself in the head. Oof. And he had written one word, the word counselor was found on his screen with his lifeless body. And so it's like, well, what did counselor? What is counselor? So that was sort of the last thing that he wrote. So this is a short story for Hunter S. Thompson called Counselor. I'm not even sure it's a story. Counselor, my dear deadbeat boy, the word swings through my brain like an untethered thistle. But love whistles through the gap in my teeth. I lost it, love, finally, when it rolled beneath the ottoman. If I could return, I surely would. But it ain't the pistols that make the motocicleta saddlebag so heavy. Sigh. I say my time has come. Come and gone again. And again and again. Counselor, dear boy, the word. For Hunter S. Thompson.
It's been so much fun. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Yeah,
thank you.
I love coming.
Delightful.
I love coming in. Having this conversation.
I know.